promised you thoughts on Unix and Kaedis, but before I do that, I want to give some feedback on some of the alleged error messages that we got from various people who were struggling with things. Email of the form, my program is broken, can you look at it? Is not enormously helpful. The correct response is no. Email of the form, well, on my program runs and I get this assertion somewhere, can you look at it? The correct response is no. Email of the form, well, I have my program and I've done some work to narrow it down, and it makes it as far as the following line of code, and then when it goes to do this step, something goes wrong and I can't figure out what's going on. Can you look at it and help me figure out what's going on? The answer is you're getting closer, but the answer is still no. Because the missing piece of information is, and where is the program? I can't tell you how many emails we got of the form, my pipe code is going wrong, but I had no clue what directory the damn pipe program was in. The likelihood of my looking at it is zero, because even if I want to, I don't know where. Give me a fighting chance. Give Scott a fighting chance. There were an appalling number of cases where we did go and look at a program, only to discover, yeah, look, you know, there are problems. Some of them are the system's problems that we're still debugging. But, you know, we would discover that we had a program that was going wrong somewhere, and there was nothing to indicate that anybody tried to narrow the problem. For example, I sent out an email about a revised check macro that could be used in the, you know, in that if unless block of your initialization, right? Exactly zero of the people who had an initialization problem and asked me to look at them had bothered to insert the check macro. There were one or two people who gave me sort of specific messages that I have a problem right here, okay? But, you know, if you haven't done the work to narrow it down, I'm not going to, and I'm telling Scott not to. We tried to send out mail to ask people to do this, and the reason I'm raising it is, I'm sorry, this is part of software development. It's part of writing programs to at least narrow down the errors. There's absolutely nothing wrong with asking for help. You should ask for help, okay? But if you can't figure out how to get to the line of code, at least, or narrow the search, I can tell you I sure don't have time to do it. And Scott doesn't have time to do it either. I want you to get help. I want to help. Scott wants to help. You need to meet us actually more than halfway in this case. And we actually sent out mail asking people to do that, and most people ignored it. So just for the record, for the final project, if we do not get specific problem reports, the answer will be, when you have a specific problem report, come ask again. It is just not that hard to insert printfs. And for those of you who did this work, I apologize. Unfortunately, many people did not, and so it needed to be said. You were starting to put something into that conversation, Brock, I thought? You're kind of waving your hand like maybe you had something put in there.
No.
Okay. Several of you hit an assert error in the space bank. I do not yet know if this error has been tracked down. The fact that I don't yet know suggests that I need to stimulate somebody fairly hard. However, I actually went through in response to that error report, and I went to all of the places where that procedure was called and put an assert at all of those places where if the assert that was tripping people up was going to fire, it should have fired at the preceding place. Basically, I figured, well, you know, there are three or four calls to this thing. One of them is probably the one that's doing it. Let's see if I can at least figure out which one, because then I'll know what the space bank was being asked to do when it went south for the winter. I put in all the asserts. Yesterday, I asked Jonathan Adams to review the asserts that I had put in to make sure that I had not missed one. We both agree, having looked at the code, that I had not missed one. And the stunning part is that none of those asserts are being triggered. So something's really wrong, and it's going to turn out to be something quite nasty. And we don't know what it is, and we're working on it. And for those of you who were gracious enough to help us in trying to narrow that case, part of the problem there was people would say, well, I have a program, and the space bank is doing an assert. And that's very frustrating. What we need is a way to reproduce it that does not entail running some large body of other code. And in most cases, what I suspect was happening is something in the initialize sequence was failing. The code was branching to exit gracelessly. And that's easy to check. If you were encountering that assert, just put a printf and exit gracelessly. We'll either see it or we won't. Okay? And the next thing we'll see, I bet, is that assert. The space bank was getting destroyed and something that it was doing was going wrong. We almost certainly have a pointer reference problem or a corruption problem somewhere in the space bank. We need to find that. So for those of you who helped us sort of narrow that down, I really appreciate it. We're quite stumped and that one's going to take some in-depth debugging. As to the rest, the whole discussion about yield. All right, I got this puzzling message from Scott a couple of days ago saying, if I call yield, is it guaranteed that some other process will run? And the answer is no. What yield actually does is it puts the calling process at the back, that is the last position in the ready queue. Of course, the last position might also happen to be the first position. Also, it might be, so when the priority system is fully working, it'll put you in the last position of your current priority. But if you're still the highest priority in the system, you're still going to run next, right? So yield says, run somebody else if there's anybody else who's now even temporarily higher priority than me. Yield does not give you a guarantee of execution order, and it would not have worked to test the blocking behavior. The piece you don't know, even assume that you yielded to the sync process that some of you were trying to build. This, by the way, was a test case that went beyond the requirements of the assignment that some people were just, they were poking at it to see if they really had their head around it. Suppose you successfully yield to the sync process. You do not know that the sync process will get to its read call before it is preempted. The yield can't help you here. The whole point about concurrency is concurrency happens under exactly the conditions when you really don't want it to get in your way. All right, so what's the right way to go? The one thing you might imagine doing is you could say, well, okay, I will kick off the sync process. I will somehow contrive to get a process capability to it, like maybe I'll ask it for one. And I will use the process capability to make inquiries so that I will know when it has blocked. And then I'll know that it's blocked and it's waiting, and then I can kick off the write. This won't work either. First, you don't necessarily know that it is blocked on the output end of the pipe. It could be blocked in the space bank trying to allocate storage. You don't know. So you have to do actually a lot more analysis to figure that out. And actually, you don't have enough information even to analyze what it is called, because it's calling a capability that you don't have, and you don't know what that other capability is. Furthermore, the kernel will not disclose outside of the kernel any distinction between a process that is running executing instructions and a process that is blocked. As far as the outside world is concerned, a blocked process is running infinitely slowly. The reason for this is and we may have carried it too far, but there's a principle that nothing gets disclosed until A, there's a compelling reason to disclose it, and in this case there's not, because there's no well-founded use of that information. And B, having decided that it would be useful to disclose it, determining that it is safe to disclose it. Problem with disclosing blocking is it can disclose quite a lot about the timing behavior of the system. This is one of these cases where the kernel does not disclose blocking details, because if it were to do so, it would be disclosing a great deal of potential channel information. Coupled with the fact that there actually isn't any robust way to use that information, because you know it's blocked, but what's it blocked on is not something you know. But there's no use to exposing it. That approach won't work. One approach that might work is to implement an additional method on the pipe control channel, which would either say, do you have somebody blocked on your read channel, or return to me when you have somebody blocked on your read channel. Now, blocked on your read channel is a little careful. Blocked on your read channel does not mean I sent the wood block request and I believe that guy's coming back. He's not blocked yet. I don't know if he's going to honor the protocol. If you actually want to test that case with robust information, it's a surprisingly difficult test to execute and actually know that you've really executed the test. The way people would do this particular test in, you know, in sort of real test cases is they'd kick off a reader, they would wait some unreasonable amount of time, and then they would kick off the writer. And that's how people actually write this kind of test case in the real world, exactly because this kind of analysis of, well, so exactly what state is that thing in now, is very hard to do. So welcome to one of the many joys of concurrency. The problem with concurrency is you often have almost no control over the actual order of operation. I mean, you have a theory about how it's going to work, but unless you've implemented something that enforces a blocking and an ordering, I don't know what's really going to happen. Suppose you had two syncs, two sync processes, right? You know, both of them block. So now what order do they read in? You could find that out by having them do the prints when they read, but until it happens, you've got no way to know, because what you know is when the read becomes available, these two processes are going to wake up. They're going to go onto the ready queue in some order. I don't know what order that is. The kernel doesn't know what order that is until it does it. There's nothing in the specification that makes a commitment about what order that is. And so, in fact, a test case that tested that there was some particular order, in some sense, is an erroneous test case, right? It's expecting a behavior that is not specified to happen. You may want to do it for convenience or for exploratory purposes, but it's not a correctness criteria. So this is actually tricky. I mean, I guess what I'm trying to get at here is debugging concurrency is actually really, really hard. The problem here is there's a race. You can have the sync say, well, I'm about to read, and do the read. But if you've already kicked off the writer, the write could happen in between those two operations. Right? There's no way to win there unless you delay. And then the problem with delay is, well, so what kind of delay is long enough? Now we're back to the timeout problem, which we talked about earlier in the semester, right? There are only four kinds of timeouts in the world, right? Forever, no timeout at all, instantaneous, right? Some timeout that matches some real-world, physically specified timeout after which you get to conclude that the device is hopelessly busted. But there's an empirical decision, empirical information that tells you what the right timeout value is, right? And timeout values that are wrong because there is no basis for them. And the observation is if you look at code that uses timeout values, 99 and 44 one-hundredths of the timeout values observed in real code are in that last category. They all come out of an ivory soap continuum. So concurrency is hard, and testing concurrency is hard. And the moral of this story is concurrency is bad for you and fattening. And this is actually why, if you want to do robust systems, you try to avoid concurrency, or where you have to use concurrency, you try to structure concurrency into atomic units so that at least you can say, well, that step made it, and that step made it, and that step made it, and now you can ask, does the flow come back together? Okay. So also, before I go on to the alleged topic for the day, you by now have figured out that my lectures have no actual topic. Final project. Now you were thinking it. What was that?
There won't be one.
You are such an optimist. It was canceled on account of snow. you will be, okay, some good news, right? Remember I said that we were going to sort of, we've ratcheted up from the zero stream and the null stream to the pipe stream, and then I was going to do a ratchet up that was about the same magnitude? I'm not going to do that. Okay. Actually, before I get completely off the pipe stream, simplification in the assignment that went out Wednesday night, it said, don't worry about the pipe buffer size. Notwithstanding what I said at the time, which was an outright lie, I had expected to do that simplification from the beginning because the original specification was unrealistically hard. And most of you, once you sort of took the time, I mean, some of you by that point were in total panic and not prepared to process anything. That makes, you know, dealing with the simplification hard because you can't even think about it. Those of you who were not quite at that point thought about it and concluded correctly that, okay, so the story was that there is a size S, okay, which is the maximum read-write. Okay? And there was a statement that if you did a read and you couldn't get all the data you'd asked for, you would block. This is not like the Unix pipe behavior that was intentional. That was a source of confusion for some people. They kept thinking, why does it behave like a pipe? The answer is, it's not a Unix pipe. Modification was that the buffer inside the pipe at 2s and rows. I hope grows didn't give anybody horrible difficulty. Interesting part was the starts at 2s. Starts at 2s has the effect of guaranteeing that you will never need to worry about a write coming in that is bigger than the buffer. And you will never need to worry about a read request that is bigger than the buffer. The point I was actually trying to get at by specifying the problem that way was, in fact, the only way you could satisfy the problem if this constraint is not present was by cheating. Actually could technically get away with the size of S. Why is S a problem? The problem with the size of S is, suppose my S is 50, okay? And I come along and I write 50 bytes. And you read 25. Now we got 25 left. If the buffer is size S and I come along and read another 50 bytes, I'm not gonna make progress until the buffer drains. But if you come along and demand 50 bytes on a read, you're not gonna make progress until 50 bytes are there. And we saw this law, it went on the books in Indiana earlier in the semester. If two trains are scheduled to come to a crossing within 5 minutes of each other, both must stop, and neither can continue until the other has passed out of sight. It's exactly that case. If the buffer size is S, right, the constraints will induce deadlock. If the buffer size is 2S, it is not possible for that deadlock to happen. Right, the read can block because there's insufficient data, but in any data situation where the read might block, there's enough space for a full write to go. And if a full write goes, then any read that would be blocked can make progress. So the point of the initial misspecification was to actually force you down this rat hole to see why there was a rat at the bottom. All of you waved to the rat, and several of you screamed. For record, just for future reference, rats, they do bite, but they don't eat very much. There's no real reason to scream. What's that?
I said Baltimore rats.
Well, yeah, Baltimore rats are a little bigger than normal rats. And even just the four-legged ones. Okay, so the point, though, is that if this constraint is present, that sort of problem in the constraint structure can't arise by prior arrangement. It's precluded by prior arrangement. And the point here is, look, sometimes the right answer is just to make the badness not possible. It's much better to specify something like this to say, well, just make sure the design allows enough space that I can't get, you know, hung up on a hook somewhere, right? And engineer the problem out. Because the amount of code it's going to take you to sort this case out is horrible. The only way to solve this problem was basically to put in an extra buffer at the front, which was going to hold the currently pending read, the most recent one that had gotten blocked. Now, that was a sleazy way out, right? It amounted to adding space to the buffer. It was undocumented. Which is what a good engineer does when they're faced with unsatisfiable constraints that they're not entitled to change. But in this case, the answer was lie. Or change the spec, right? The other way you could have gotten out of this was to say, oh, well, okay, so I'm just gonna lie, right? I mean, the right thing to do under these conditions is say, the guy who wrote the spec is a moron. If they ask me to change the size to 5, and I have to handle a write of 500, the answer is to say, good, the size is now 5. And just internally ignore that fact. Or set a lower bound, right? You actually do want to be able to shrink this buffer, but it is reasonable to say, and I'm not going to shrink it below 2s. The final way out, and this, well, maybe there are others, but sort of the last on my list of ways out for this afternoon, is to adopt the Unix pipe specification, which says, if you ask for 50 bytes on a read and there are 25, you will get 25. Don't block unless the residual bytes in the buffer is 0. That also guarantees that all buffer sizes above 0 work. One byte buffer is probably, at that point, probably shouldn't buffer. The Unix specification deals with this by basically defining the problem away by guaranteeing that the reads can't block in any situation where you get into trouble. There is still the issue that you want to be able to take a full write the way we specified this. The ASCII specification says, if you do a write that is smaller than the buffer size, we reserve the right to only process up to the buffer size. Only atomic in the Unix specification up to the buffer size. and we will return a short value indicating that not all of your write was processed, and adequacy is violated, and too bad. And both of those decisions are appropriate if your mental model is that a stream is a byte sequence. Some of you may have heard of this really astounding innovation in computer science called a record. The problem with the way the Unix pipe system is specified is you cannot use it for record structured I.O. If you're lucky, and your record size is below the pipe buffer limit, then you could say, I'll put things in one record at a time. You could say, I'll read things out one record at a time. Here's what happens. Then there is some last write. And that last write is the one that overflows the buffer. That write will complete partially. Now you're going to do a series of reads of those records, read, 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 and the last read will complete partially. And once you have read a partial record out of the stream in the multiple consumer scenario, or in the multiple producer scenario, there is no way to recover. There's no way to resynchronize. So there was actually a good reason why this specification said reads and writes are atomic off of the size limit. Because then at least if you're within the size limit, you can get record structures with multiple producers and multiple consumers. And it made the size adjustable. Now, in a real world implementation, you could either implement a different object to simulate a Unix pipe, or we'd have some kind of a method to the respective streams to basically say, well, I'm willing to take best effort, or I want non-blocking I.O., or I want 15 billion other options on I.O. that streams seem to need to have for programmers to be happy, because life isn't complicated enough, programmers aren't happy. This is not the Unix stream. And it does some things that the Unix stream doesn't do. Namely, it can do record structure in the presence of multiple producers and multiple consumers. Challenge problem, you know, for your Christmas break. Try to do a multiple producer, multiple consumer scenario with Unix pipe. It does record structured I.O. and serves record boundaries. I don't believe you can do it. At least, I say that more carefully. I don't think you can do it without querying the buffer every time you do a write. Or in fact, just before you do a write. No, that even won't work with multiple producers. And also having some kind of a semaphore so that all of the writes are serialized. Because the protocol is going to have to be, grab a lock so that nobody else will write, find out how much stuff is in the buffer to figure out if my write will fit. If it will, do it. Otherwise, somehow communicate with the guy on the read side to find out when the buffer will bring. Maybe some built-in mechanism that will help with pieces of that. But you're going to force yourself into exactly the thing that you were trying to avoid, which was a lock that's commonly shared among all writers, maybe another one of your readers. Not that you could get rid of that lock, but you were trying, and that lock had to exist because obviously you don't want two parties, even in the kernel, reading out of the buffer at the same time. But you'd like the acquisition and deacquisition of that lock to occur in the same path as the rest of the processing, otherwise it gets progressively more expensive. So, you know, when you're or at your Christmas festivities, pull out the common Unix specification. What?
Gather around children.
Gather around children. Yes, yes, yes. It's good for parents too, right? Now, if you offer to read it to them, they will leave you alone. Okay. I promise it works. My mother runs. Not really. She's 77 years old. She doesn't run so fast. Audience, yeah, as it were. Yes, I think I'll just stop with that. Okay, so Unix get run. Switching gears to the promised alleged or allegedly promised lecture. This is not maybe the usual take on this because I'm not really interested in grand scale features here. We've been looking at microkernel stuff. We've been looking at a pretty kernel-centric view of the world this semester. I think it's worth sort of looking at it from that. One thing that you could argue that Unix gets right. If you look at the specification of system calls in Unix, you will discover that there are only, well, there are variations on the theme, but there are basically only two system calls that touch more than one address space. Those are fork. Exec. And in a perverse sort of way, exec actually does not touch two address spaces. There's a moment where it drops your current address space and it inserts your new address space, but it's, and it may even temporarily in the implementation hold them both at the same time. But in abstract, there is no information that crosses the exec boundary. No, that's not true. But all the stuff that crosses the exec boundary occurs through the environment pointer in argv. And there is in the specification hiding somewhere, don't ask me where because I don't remember. At least in System 5, it was in the ABI for the platform. There's a specification that sets an upper bound above which the implementation is entitled to say, look, I don't care if you have more environment. It's not getting there. Which is over 7 pounds. FedEx will not deliver it. So in principle, you can implement exact by just copying that stuff to a holding buffer of bounded size, set up a new address space, you know, put it in the new process, which is a bit of a pain in the butt because it's a complex mechanism, but it can be done. So you're either cleanly in one space or cleanly in the other space. And there are no system calls in Unix that actually move data from one space to the other. Or excuse me, there are no system calls that are required to do that. You can do that indirectly by sharing memory, but the kernel never has to change the address space pointer to do that. That's what I'm getting at here. There are optimizations of pipe in particular that will do the cross-space copy, but that is an elective optimization, and the kernel is always entitled to fall back to the copy. It is hard to express how big a simplification that is. Fork, by the way, also never touches the same address space, right? There's a moment where it does this fissioning operation, and there's sort of a really brief window where it's setting up the new process. But while it's setting up the new process, it is not running out of the new address space. In the old address space. When the new process runs, the new process is running in the new address space, right? The kernel, during the course of that operation, the only reason it's going to have to switch an address space pointer is because there's a preemption that forces it to run some other process. It's not a consequence of the semantics of the system call. So actually, even those two that on the face of them manipulate multiple address spaces don't. There are system calls in Unix that if you contrive the right conditions, those system calls are guaranteed to block. For example, pull the pipe far enough and you set up the I/O constraints correctly, you can make the next write block. But what happens in that case is that the process gets to a certain point on a stall queue and some other process executes, and then later this process unblocks and it continues, right? And eventually we hope it returns. More likely your system crashes, but that's, you know, that's a problem of implementation. So one of the consequences of that is that system calls return the same space. I do a message into the kernel. Either the answer is coming back to me or no answer is coming back. Right? I mean, if my system call is exit, things are a little peculiar. Exit is a little funny because it can change the state of the parent process that's waiting for me. But that does not generally manifest as a directly returned message. That process may have executed a wait may be blocked. This may cause a wake up. It is not the case that exit is returning to wait. It's the case that exit is stashing some information that will later allow wait to return to itself. This crosstalk, this is not a messaging operation. If, you know, we went through the invocation path in the Kaeda's kernel, and you saw that the answer is, you know, you invoke the kernel and it replies on the reply capability, and if you feel like it, that reply capability need not point to you. I can invoke the kernel and say, send the message back to him. And we saw that there's a huge number of corner cases that the kernel has to guard itself against in order to deal with that. In fact, if you were to go back and look at the Eros implementation of the same conceptually similar path, you would discover that there are two versions of the path. And the first one says, am I doing a call instruction? Because the call instruction is guaranteed to return to the caller if it returns at all. If it's doing the call instruction, there's a laundry list of about 25 consistency checks that it doesn't have to do. It doesn't. So the structure of the path is, if I am doing a call on a kernel capability, hijack the path here because I'm doing the simple case, and we'll just go through the one that doesn't have the checks. And that's like 100% of all calls. And then if I have to do the general path, I'll do it, but that path is actually labeled the slow path. Actually, it cherry picks two paths. It cherry picks the cross-process path, because in that case, we're not going to deal with the reply. And so for the same reason, we don't have to do the sanity checks. and it cherry picks the call on kernel capability case. And then the general path is the yicky one that we've walked through. Coyotes just hasn't gotten to the point where that level of optimization is appropriate. We will. We have to get the yicky path first. Then we can figure out what to take out. We start with the general one and work down. Of course, the price of this in Unix is that Unix isn't a messaging system. Now, we could argue about whether that's good or bad, right? We're now arguing theology. Those of you who don't belong to a church need to join one so that you'll understand what I'm talking about. You can then quit. Maybe there's a simpler way to figure it out. I don't know. Go take a philosophy class. They like to argue in philosophy classes. That's like theology. So tremendous simplification in that fact. In fact, part of the reason, if you look at the core Linux kernel, okay, and you strip out the networking stuff, getting better at substituting, and you strip out the drivers, and you strip out the file systems, none of which in some sense are conceptually core. And that's roughly the list of stuff that you would strip out if you were doing a microkernel, roughly. And then you count the remaining lines of code. You'll discover that Linux is only twice the size of a production quality microkernel. Now, the L4 community would argue with that, right? The L4 community will actually try to tell you with a straight face that you can build a production quality kernel that runs in 12 kilobytes. They actually have a kernel that runs in 12 kilobytes. It is not production quality. Production quality includes things like asserts, f, and if you have printf, you've already done 400 lines in your kernel or more. Not that you want to run that code in production, but the code exists. It's dubious whether you want to turn it off, and it has to be maintained. So yes, it may be small from the standpoint of what am I actually doing to run, but from the standpoint of the complexity of the system I have to maintain, it's not really that small. Also, in the L4 case, there are some data structures, at least in the older L4 systems, whose management is shared between the kernel and Sigma Zero, which is their primordial address space manager. So if you look at the size of the kernel, you get one answer, but if you look at the size of the primordial TCB, right, you get a different answer. And this stuff is, Sigma Zero in their system is out of kernel, but it's a shared memory interface with the kernel, and each of them relies critically on the correct behavior of the other. And at that point, the accident of the fact that it's not running in supervisor mode doesn't mean that you don't have to count the lines for purposes of understanding the complexity of what's going on. Don't get me wrong, there are good reasons to run that as a process. It makes it schedulable, lets you take advantage of mechanisms operating at a lower level of abstraction, but that process does have an incestuous relationship with the kernel, and if you're trying to understand the complexity of the system, incest has to be factored in. Boy, I can see that one coming. The overwhelming majority of system calls in Unix return a bit in the classic implementation, which was the carry bit. It's no longer done that way, because they eventually discovered a processor that didn't have a carry bit. May have been overflow. Yeah, it was overflow. Historically, the implementation was, if the overflow bit was set, what you had gotten back was an error code, and the one register that you were going to get back held the ear node. It held the negative of the ear node. With the one exception of mmap, for which there wasn't a good out-of-band value. And if the overflow flag was not set, then what you were getting back was the normal return. But notice that in most cases, the normal return is something like a length, or it's something like zero, or it's something like an address that nicely fits in the register. The exceptions to that statement are the read operation, which might do a copy out, but that copy out has already happened by the time the return occurs. And the other exception is things like IOCuddle. IOCuddle is the garbage pit of the Unix interface. It's where you shove something if there isn't a well-founded place to put it. And so it's a harm. When they were doing remote file system work at AT&T, there were they had to impose some changes on the system. There actually were IOCuddles that had both inbound data arguments, indirect arguments, buffers, and outbound buffers. It turns out that when you're doing a remote messaging protocol, you really want buffers to flow in one direction or the other, but not both. Actually changed some of the interface to do that. But they actually had to build in a decoder that knew enough to decode every possible IOCuddle value so they could turn those things into messages. So IOCuddle's a swamp. But if you set aside IOCuddle, what you're left with in terms of IO operations is read. Read is actually a fairly well-isolated system call in the structure of the scheme, right? It does its work, is generally operating from a buffer, whether it's a network buffer or a file system buffer. There's a cap on how much read you get to do before the system says, come on, get a life. And so generally, read turns into a memory copy. Exceptions are things like the terminal subsystem, where you're not going to move a lot of data under any conditions because there isn't going to be a lot. Well, there's a certain sense in which the Unix system call structure is very simple. And it's certainly proven to be very capable. So all this, I think, is stuff that Unix can be said to have gotten right, with the possible exception of this part. Right? And the problem with sleeping in the kernel is you've got the possibility of kernel deadlock. On the monolithic kernel versus microkernel debate, there is an undeniable advantage to a monolithic design, which is a monolithic design, because it all operates in one address space, is usually able to do copy avoidance much more simply than microkernel design. Right? Because a microkernel design, it's got to arbitrage across spaces. Somewhere you've got to do a DMA, right? So I'm a process, I want to get a packet off the network. I go to the Ethernet driver. The Ethernet driver has two choices. It puts the packet in its memory and copies it to me. Or it somehow pins my memory and sets up the DMA part to go to my memory. Well, actually, for inbound packets, it almost has to do a copy to me, because it has to interpret the packet to make sure that it's going to me. For outbound packets, you can do direct I/O, but you can't do direct I/O unless you can pin down the pages. And one of the problems with the microkernel is it's hard to design an efficient mechanism by which I can send you a mapping into my space that you could then use to pin the right location. It's actually hard to do. So if you're going to set something like this up, and it's particularly the problem with DMA that makes this really unpleasant. Put yourself in a situation where you basically have to set up buffers by prior arrangement, pin them down, and then get both sides to agree to use the same storage. That's hard to do. It's complicated. The things that in a Unix design seem simple, they're not, are much harder to do in a microkernel. Excuse me. Things that in a monolithic design seem simple are harder to do in a microkernel. Yeah, trade-offs. I mean, you know, that's the coin, right? The thing that the copying was getting you was a certain kind of isolation. And it was isolation both of security, but also of contracts for durability. Right? The reason Unix can do these kinds of tricks, one of the reasons, is that it uses reference counting. The problem with reference counting is I can be charged for something that I cannot delete. Deleted is because I previously agreed to share it with you, and you haven't let go yet. I don't have any way in the Unix mechanism to summarily destroy an object. So if you hold a descriptor to an object, in general in Unix there is no back pointer to that descriptor. No idea what that is. Somebody canceling something I forgot to cancel. Okay, so there's no active destroy. The storage accountability in Unix is hard. Now, that can cut both ways too, right? Because there's no active destroy, if you provide me with a buffer and I'm going to make reference to it, I do not have to worry about the case of the buffer going away. It's a set of memory errors that are very hard to recover from that I don't have to deal with. So like in the Eros window system, we have a setup that works like this. I'll illustrate the other side of it. Here's the client that is the application that's doing graphics stuff. And when it uses a double buffering scheme. The client has, in that design, a frame buffer. This is not the hardware frame buffer, this is the client frame buffer. And if we wanted to do this in a really high performance thing, this would not be a frame buffer of bits, it would be a frame buffer of rendering commands. But let's leave that aside. The window system is up here, and it also has a capability into this frame buffer. The actual protocol is that when a new client comes up, it goes to the window system and says, here is a source of storage, please fabricate a buffer and give me back the buffer that you built out of my storage. The reason the window system has to fabricate this is the window system needs to know who the fault handler is. Actually, it turns out it doesn't. Anyway, they get this buffer mapped, and the way the client draws is it updates its buffer, and then it goes to the window manager and says, inside this buffer, I've just changed something inside this rectangle. And I'll tell you the smallest possible rectangle, because I don't want you to redraw more than you have to. And the window system, I'm sorry, I said frame buffer. This is not correct. This is a window buffer. The window system knows what the position of this window is front to back, and it can compute what portion of this rectangle is actually visible on your display. And the Windows system does a memory copy from there to there. So it's an inherently double buffering scheme. Now, you know, if you're a graphics junkie, you know the double buffering is actually something you want to do because there's this hicky thing called vertical retrace. And for that matter, there's horizontal retrace. Vertical retrace is the thing that makes stupid graphics game implementations flicker like crazy, right? Because they do half of a screen update and then the retrace, and during retrace, and then you actually see the other half happen. That's what makes the display look glitchy. So what you actually want to do is set it all up in a second buffer and then flip the darn thing during the vertical retrace so there's no moment that the user ever sees a screen that's halfway through an update. Well, this will get you that. You can basically constrain the copies to only happen during vertical retrace intervals. From a visual standpoint, it's actually very pretty. And this is how the Apple Window Manager works, ignoring acceleration. Another advantage of it is, hey, we can shut the window system off, and you can still draw, and the fact that there's no display, you're completely oblivious to that, which means that we can take your entire desktop and we can park it when you log out. Your programs can still be running. And there's the reason I was telling the story about this capability. This is a capability to a memory region that came from storage owned by this client, from a space bank. All of you learned in the last 2 weeks, to your discontent, space blanks have a destroy operation. What happens when you destroy a space bank is that the kernel panics on it. What happens when you destroy a space bank is that all space allocated from that bank is destroyed. Okay? Which means that this window buffer goes to the great bit bucket in the sky. After it goes to the great bit bucket in the sky, the window system says, oh, the client now trying to break the window system says, now, I've updated this rectangle. The window system says, good, let me go see what's there. Read. As I'm sure you all can imagine, writing a program that is able to gracefully recover from the failure of an arbitrarily selected load instruction is a really easy thing to do. Particularly so in a language that doesn't have exception handling. The rest of you can listen to the tape when you get home. In fact, if you were to look at the procedure, because the window system was implemented in C, if you look at it, you will discover that it has its own little copy of memcopy. And what that memcopy does is it sets a recovery point. And there is a fault handler sitting on the side. Okay? And at startup, the window manager takes off the fault handler and says, by the way, if I fault between here and here, reset my PC to there and put the following turn in the following register so that I know how I got there. It knows the starting address of this memcopy procedure and the ending address of this memcopy procedure, and it has a similar level recovery point, and it says to the handler, if you catch me doing a read reference fault in the middle of this memcopy procedure, pick up my program counter, move it over there, and start me again, and I will recover. So that's how it recovers from the bad load. Now that idiom will work fine if you have something like this where the offending memcopy really only happens in one place and you're prepared to check the error result. By the way, what does it do if the memcopy fails? If the memcopy fails, the client broke the contract. I broke the contract and you're no longer under any obligation to render the bits, which is good because they've gone to the great bit bucket in the sky, so rendering them would be challenging. Okay. We're also going to sever any connections that the client may still have, right? You only get to fool me once. This is a level of defensive programming that would be hard to do in Java, by the way, because Java won't tell us things like, where is the memory region that might hurt us? This idiom is sort of it's an idiom that is safe by virtue of the way the program is designed to recover. It's not safe by virtue of language recognition. In Unix, this scenario can't happen. And if your window manager goes south for the winter, you may get left with a buffer you can't get rid of. Better still, if your window manager leaks memory, you can get to places where the only thing to do is the three-fingered salute. So you know what two of those fingers are. Control Alt Backspace, right? It is one of the more common recovery mechanisms, you know, when your Linux window manager decides to be creative. Less common than it used to be, but still far too common. So here's the question that arises. is it better to have a system, is it more important to have a system in which this class of error is something that you do not have to guard against? Or is it more important to have a system in which mechanisms of storage accountability work? Okay. And look, this one's not so bad, right? Windows just aren't very big. If you've got hung up with extra space for a window for a while, there's some flex. We can tolerate this for quite a long time. But suppose you write a multi-gigabyte DVD image to the drive. You've been sharing files, right? And you've got some large video on your drive that you're not going to tell me about, right? RIAA will pursue you, because that's what RIAA likes to do. So what's the RIAA strategy? The RIAA strategy is to install a virus on your, this is not actually what they do, is to install a virus on your machine that will open the file. You don't have to do anything with it, it just has to hold it open. You can now delete it all you want, it's not going anywhere, because that file can't go away until the last open goes away, and that program is holding it open. The example is contrived. I actually have seen cases where you have some very large log file that's just obviously from some program that's gotten out of control, and you really need your disk space back. Actually, because logs files tend to go on the root file system, which is about the last place you want them. And you've just run out of space on the root file system, and at this point the machine's about to crash anyway. One of the ideas in Unix you could argue about is the notion of ownership. I want to be careful here. I don't mean ownership in the sense of permissions. Yes, Unix ties the UID to the notion of permissions, and I established pretty early in the semester that I thought that was an unmitigated disaster. What I mean is ownership in the sense of labeling. You might want it to be the case that I could put a file in the file system. I get identified as the owner of that file, but my account goes away, or I go away, and I see the pizza brigade has arrived. Someone's optimistic about the break schedule. I go away, or the source of storage goes away. We want the file not to go away, right? We'd like to be able to retask that storage to somebody else so we can preserve it. In fact, we'd like to be able to delete the account and then realize too late, oh crap, I needed that file. The storage accountability can be too strong. It's not clear that we've gotten this right in Coyote's theorems. UIDs for permissions are different now. Last item, one that you've all hit, and then we'll break. By the way, it's a novel strategy for shortening the lecture. I congratulate you. Labeling. Okay, so one of the problems, and actually we're wrestling with this at the Aerospace as well. I have something going wrong, right? I have messages that are getting logged to someplace. I have no idea what program wrote these messages to log. But, and even if I did, I could imagine, the program saying, hi, my name is Fred and I'm writing this message to the log. And then the log would say, well, Fred said, whatever. Fine. Which Fred? There have been 15 copies of a Fred program running. I have no idea which one just did me dirt. I need more information. What I probably need is the identity. I'm not interested just in what was the name of the program, but also what was the name of the process, because I want the instance of the program, because that's what I have to debug. I might even like to be able to create some kind of a trail so I can, particularly when I'm crossing process boundaries as I'm processing, so I can track, I started here and I went there and I went there and I went there and I, now what? Like this space bank error, right? Part of the problem hunting it down is we don't know which sequence of calls did us in. Identity of the process is a potentially unpleasant thing, because the identity we want, in some sense, is the object ID of that process. But there is no way to turn an object ID back into a capability. That's intentional. So there's a problem of labeling. And assuming I knew which program was going wrong, there's a problem of getting my paws on that process in order to debug it. There actually is a design for how to do a on-demand debugging subsystem. The catch with that is, who gets to decide? So there are programs where the user has to be in control because the program is currently holding some information supplied by the user. You might care about disclosing that before it gets debugged. Simultaneously, there are programs where the program holds information that's proprietary to the program operator. So in some sense, both parties have to consent before inspection can be permitted. That's actually moderately tricky to get right. The bad news in Unix is, you know, everybody knows the root password, and you can crack open any process you want. And the good news is you can crack open any process you want, figure out what happened. And there's a similar labeling problem in auditing that I guess I'll come to in a little bit. Why don't we take a break?
Reason to let things get cold.